If you go back to the 10th of September last year when we started the LHC up, what had we done before that? Actually, what we had done was the LHC is in 8 individual sectors, which can be, each sector can be cooled down and tested, all the power supplies tested individually. And we had already done 7 sectors, taking them up to 5.5 TV, the current equivalent to 5.5 TV, which we were going to operate, start operation at 5 TV. And the 8th sector, we'd taken actually up to 4 TV. And then we had to stop because the 10th of September was a drop-dead date for the media, etc., for starting up. And of course, when we inject the beam, we inject at much lower energy. So we actually stopped pushing that sector up for that reason. And then we started commissioning the machine. Things went extremely well and extremely quickly. But of course, in order to proceed further than just having the beam injected and circulating, then we had to bring this last sector up. And we did this on the 19th. I remember it very well. On the 19th, the crew in the control room was working on this last sector with exactly the same protocol. There is a written protocol for the sequences of how to go. So there was no question of cutting corners or anything. And by that time, it had got to be rather routine. I remember I was actually over in the personnel department haggling about some triviality. And I got a call on my mobile to say that something bad had gone wrong. So I immediately went over to the control room. And as soon as I walked in, I could see all the alarm screens, you know, showing faults. Many faults on the magnets, the vacuum system, etc. It was obviously a serious problem. We also had alarms coming out of the tunnel that there was helium venting into the tunnel. Clearly it was something very big. So then we assembled a crisis unit to decide what to do. I mean, in a situation like that, first of all, to understand what happened. So we sent a few people into the tunnel. One has to be very careful with safety, of course. If there is helium in the atmosphere, helium itself is not poisonous, but you can't, it excludes the oxygen. So first we sent the fire brigade in there with a breathing equipment. And then when the tunnel had vented enough, the oxygen was reestablished, then we could go in. And we found a very bad situation, icing up on the magnets. Clearly, there had been we put the picture together rather quickly, although we had several months of inquiry afterwards. What had happened was that one of the soldered joints, the brazed joints between two magnets, had failed catastrophically. Now, there are 10,000 of these in the machine, and one of them had failed, which meant that it opened up, produced an electrical arc, and this is all inside the liquid helium vessel, pierced the containment tube, and then vented helium into the magnets. And the pressure of the helium got so high, the pressure relief valves opened, so helium went into the tunnel. But even they could not cope with the volume of helium. And that was the big problem, is that the pressure went up too high. And this actually pushed magnets off their supports. Wow. Because every 200 meters, we have a vacuum barrier, which is to separate the vacuum of one sector from another. And if you've got vacuum on one side of that barrier, and 4 atmospheres of pressure on the other, then there is a longitudinal force of about 15 ton. Right. That pushes these, and that this is what did the most of the damage. It was not the actual the incident itself, but the collateral damage because of the high pressures. So we made of course a very serious investigation. We had a fact finding commission, etc., and we went through all this. Signals that were coming out leading up to the incident, because we've got a lot of diagnostics there. And we put a picture together that it was this joint which had a higher resistance in it that we didn't detect. It's in fact impossible to measure resistance of 100 nanohms is a tiny resistance, but it's still high for us. Measuring that at room temperature is excluded. We, of course, tried to simulate making such a high resistance in the lab, in the interconnect. And actually, the only way that we could simulate it at all was that, in fact, that joint had not been brazed. It had been assembled, and once it's assembled, then there should be an induction brazing with a pressure of 210 on the joint and heated up to 180 degrees, at least 180 degrees centigrade, to fuse the solder. And okay, the quality control failed on one joint, one in 10,000, which in itself is not surprising at a level of 10 to the minus 4. But of course, the consequences were very serious. Mm. So I think that once we had all recovered from the shock of the incident, then we had to put together a plan.
What was it like for you going down there and seeing that, or even just this happening after like spending so much time and like effort on it?
Yeah, well, it was a real kick in the teeth for everybody, because you know we've had our ups and downs in this project. We've had quite serious problems in the past. And to see this on at the very end, I mean, this was literally the last big power supply to be commissioned, was a real kicker. I mean, we were all really down, but okay. I think you cannot dwell on it. I think then there were a number of issues. First of all, to make the systems safe, because these magnets had been pushed off there. Of their supports, nevertheless, they weigh 15 tons. And to make the situation safe for people, that was the first thing to do. And then the whole extent of the damage, actually, there were 53 magnets had to be removed from the tunnel out of around 200, so about a quarter of the sector involved.
Are these the big long dipoles?
The big long dipoles, yeah. and some quadrupoles as well, which are shorter, which are only 5 meters long. So I think that then we proceeded on several fronts. The first was to start the cleanup, remove the damaged magnets. In fact, there is no damaged magnet in themselves. What are damaged are the interconnects between magnets. So these will all be refurbished. They've been replaced by our spares now, but they will then be put it back into our stock of spares when they're fixed. So removing the damaged magnets, cleaning up the vacuum chamber of the beam had been pierced, so there was debris in the vacuum chamber. A big cleanup job, but of course equally important for us was to understand why we didn't see it, why we didn't get a warning. That there was a bad joint, and especially how to detect any other bad joints in the machine. And from that, we went actually through, we have what we call a post-mortem system, which on any event that's happening, then basically this is a trigger which fills up memories. There are memory cards on every magnet, so it fills up with data on voltages or temperatures or whatever. And we can read all that back and try to put together a picture of
like a black box.
It's like a black box, yeah. Now, the trouble is, I mean, you would think that you would see the joint heating up and then you'd be able to switch off. But the way that the LHC is conceived, it's first of all, it's got superfluid helium, which is a very, very special form of helium with a very high thermal conductivity. So it removes heat very efficiently, but it's a quantum fluid. And the thermal conductivity is not just constant like in other materials. It collapses when the heat flux gets high. So this was one factor. It was very efficient at removing the heat until the watts per square centimeter coming through were big enough, and then it suddenly collapsed,
right.
and then of course you're in trouble. The other thing is that, of course, the cooling of LHC is in the servo, in the servo loop. So you are the servo loop keeps the temperature constant. And in fact, when we sifted through all the data, what we discovered there was one valve controlling helium flow that was slowly opening. So it was calling on more and more liquid to keep the temperature constant. And that blinded us as well. So, anyway, we managed to put together a picture of how it happened and what the precursor signal was, if we had known how to interpret it. And then we put that to good use, actually. We developed a technique which allowed us to look everywhere else in the machine in order to see if there were any more resistive joints. And in fact, we found two.
Right.
Which had already been up to the top current. They were in two. It was in two magnets, not in two interconnects, because there are joints inside the magnets as well. But of course, if the joints are very well irrigated with liquid helium, so that the power density is low, so there's a big surface area, then they are cooled perfectly well, and nothing happens. It's only in the interconnects, which is in a small pipe. There's a problem. Anyway, these two magnets have been removed. It at least gives us confidence we can spot. We now know and we are sure that there is nowhere else in the machine there is such a resistive joint. So on that front, we are now confident to start up again.
The decision to start up again will be at half the power, is that right? Half the energy is originally conceived?
Yeah, I think that now there is... I mean, it's. I know it's perfectly safe to start up at 5 TV, not yet at 7. But I think that nevertheless, we want to go up stepwise. I think that's reasonable. 3.5 or 4 TV. It's already 4 times higher energy than has ever been achieved in the past. So we will be already going into a completely new regime. This machine is not operated by experts. It's operated 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So it's got to be operated by the main control room operators. So we have to give them some experience as well, and give them some. You know, we don't want to be too near the edge in the beginning. Mm-hmm. So it's quite reasonable that we crank the energy up. We will go up to 3.5 or 4 TV in the first phase. Stay there for a while. Enough time to get a meaningful sample of data, because there's no point in just being there for a day. And you've got to accumulate a sample of data of that energy, and then we will agree with the experiments and we will take the machine up. This year we will take it up to 5 TV, as we intended to last year.
Before the end of this year?
Before the end of next year.
Right.
We will start up in November this year, and we will run all the way through to November next year. And I would say that we will be going up to 5 TV at the latest in spring.
Mm-hmm.
And then we will sit there until the end of the year. And then, of course, I will not be here. I will be retired by then. But then we have to see what additional consolidation is needed. One thing I didn't say is that as a consequence of the incident, of course, top priority was fixing the magnets and finding a way to detect bad joints. But also we did a lot of work on the sectors that are accessible, which means the ones that are warm, in order to increase the number of relief valves, etc. So if such an incident happened, then the collateral damage would be less. I mean, the important thing is that it doesn't happen. But so that's been done on half of the machine. So before we take it up to 7 TV, then we want to do it on the other half. So that's got to wait now until a shutdown of 2010-2011, and we will equip the other half.
Is it adding more valves, or is there an early warning system? I mean, you were talking earlier about how one valve had been slowly releasing. I mean, are you having monitors on these things so you can see how the system's trying to cope with?
Yeah, I think we are. What we are doing is putting more pressure relief valves in the system. Clearly, for a fault of this magnitude, the pressure relief that we'd foreseen was not adequate by any means. But nobody's built anything like the LHC before, and we did not, frankly, expect such a big event. Of course, with what we've learned, we've written a lot, we've put a lot of software in now for monitoring of these parameters that we saw in our postmortem data. So I think 5 TeV in the first run, and then up to 7 TeV or close to it. We've already been close to 7 TeV in one sector without any problem at all. But that we will take it let's say a lot slower than we intended to in the past.
There's been some talk in the media about the some of the superconducting magnets not working as well as designed.
Yeah. Well, that's not. I mean, it's a small thing. It's an annoying thing. The superconducting magnets came from three manufacturers, and they've all been tested up to the top energy. And when you when you test these magnets, you have to go through a phenomenon called training, where the magnet will go up to a certain field and then it will quench, and then the next time you power it, then it will go up to a higher field, and you may have to quench it two or three or four times to get it up to the top. What's happening physically, what's happening there, is that the mechanical forces are so huge inside the magnets, it's pushing the conductors into place effectively.
Right.
And when they move, then they produce frictional heat, and therefore they warm up the coil. That's a quench. Well, even on the benches, what we found was that the quench behavior of the three manufacturers were quite different. And one manufacturer was quite remarkable. In fact, it would have first quench at a rather low field and then go straight up to the top. So one quench to put it in place, and then whereas the others were going up more gradually. So as a consequence, the magnets from this manufacturer have seen many less quenches than the other manufacturers. But of course, what we discovered when we took the first sector up to top energy, we were getting one quench from a magnet of this kind, and then we would never see it again. But one quench, you know, if one quenches, then the rest haven't seen it. So it's a slow process. There are 400 of them, so we may have to do 400 quenches. We don't know, really. But what we do know is if a magnet gets a quench, you won't see it again, and you won't see it while the machine is still cold.
When you say you won't see it again?
Then you will take the current up higher, and next time a different one will quench, not
right.
The same one.
Right.
The one that's been trained is out of the problem. So that is a bit of an issue. What I know from the experience of one sector that went up is that we went very fast up to 6.5 TeV. It's a question of a couple of days, but that last half TeV is a bother. Mm. So there is that issue, and there is also an issue now that we are completely neurotic about. Well, understandably so, about the splices. There has been an issue of the copper bus bar. It's a bit difficult to explain, but the superconductor is inside a copper stabilizer. Mm-hmm. That if the bus bar is carrying the currents.
This is internally in the magnet.
From one magnet to another. Where this joint is. I'm not talking about the superconducting joint is the thing that failed, but there is also a continuity in the copper. That has to be good, because if a bus bar quenched like a magnet, it's very unlikely that a bus bar quenches, because it's not in a high field like the magnets are. Then the copper stabilizer has to carry the current as the power supply is going down, and if you've got a high resistance in that copper, then you're going to get heating up. And in fact, we've also found a few of what we call outliers, where the resistance in as the joint was made was higher than foreseen, and we are weeding them out. We think we've repaired them all,
right.
But before we go up to 7 TeV, we better be damn sure. So that's another reason to take it a bit very carefully, of course. But like I say, getting up to 3.5 TeV is already puts us way ahead of the. Of the competition, let's say. So it's a valuable step. We would not we had not foreseen to do it before, but I think it's wise to go that way now. Mm. Get some confidence back and get some training of the staff.
And so just take through very, very quickly how next year is likely to pan out. I mean, presumably there is a lot of time that has to be spent doing early collisions just to calibrate the detectors and such, right?
Yeah, I think, of course, we start up again, as we started up last year, getting two beams circulating at the injection energy. The experiments have asked for a short amount of time colliding the beams at the injection energy, which nevertheless produces the first interesting events. Mm. Not new events. These are particles that were discovered in CERN in the 80s, the W and Z particles. But they're great for calibrating the detectors, because we know what their mass is, and the detectors can measure their mass, and we'll see if they are well calibrated. So that will be a question of a few days after probably with the experience that we have now. I think within 2 weeks of startup, then we will be there. Then we will accelerate the beams up to 3.5 GeV, and then we will start to go into a routine operation, filling the machine and then colliding them for as long as the experiments are happy that they've got a sample of data that they can do meaningful physics with, and we are happy that we've got the machine under good control. Then we will go up to 5 GeV as soon as we can.
Okay. So do you think the problems that the machine still has, or the way that things will progress, I mean, does that limit in any way the kind of things you hope to look for?
Well, you always want the highest possible energy. I think 7 GeV is better than 5. I mean, there's no doubt about that. But nevertheless, 5 GeV is a very substantial energy. I'm not a theorist, but what the theorists tell us is that, for instance, if supersymmetry exists, then it will become very clear very quickly. For the Higgs, it's always been known that the Higgs is going to be a slog.
Yeah.
Now that the Higgs has been excluded in the easy region by Fermilab, then we all know that digging the Higgs out is going to be hard. Mm. So I think that they tell me it's going to take 2 or 3 years, but it depends on how well the machine performs.
Mm, mm. What's just finally, what's the mood like in the camp at the moment? I mean, presumably there are a lot of experimentalists who at CERN at least have been without data probably for about 10 years or something like that. And obviously, presumably yourself must be really desperate to have this up and running.
Well, I think it's been 15 years building this machine, okay? And you're right, as since LEP switched off, then there has been basically no, there's been physics come out of CERN, but no frontier physics. Mm. So it's been a very frustrating time for everybody. Now, if you want to look at the upside, if there is an upside, the detectors now are in extremely good order. I think they were only partially finished last year. But now they're being completely finished. And they've also taken a huge amount of data with cosmic rays, which allows them to debug the different pieces of the detector. So these, and really understand them. You know, you can align the detector with a cosmic ray, which is a very high energy, which goes straight through the detector, and you get tracked right through it. And you can do the precision alignment, which will prove to be extremely valuable when it comes to analyzing the real data. So, yes, I think it's been tough for the experiments. It's been tough. I think above all, I think of the research students who were. I know what it's like finishing a thesis, having always funding problems at the end, and it's extremely frustrating for them. So. Let's get the machine moving and everybody can relax.